Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, a non-profit dedicated to preserving, celebrating, and teaching the history of video games. In 2017, after graduating college, my guest helped curate an Atari-themed pop-up exhibition at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo. 2 years later, Game Informer enlisted her as a volunteer to help digitise the magazine's entire archive at its Minnesota headquarters. After 5 weeks of intense work, she became the Video Game History Foundation's co-director. Described by the New Yorker magazine as compact and laser-focused, since then, she has sifted through thousands of old documents, discs, magazines, and prototypes in an effort to rescue the video game medium's history from oblivion. Once institutions can see that putting effort and funding behind video game preservation is a useful, sustainable way as possible, I think they'll do it, she recently wrote. We're working on it, but the work is just beginning. Welcome, Kelsey Lewin.
Thank you so much for having me. I hadn't really thought about my career in exactly those beats, but it's all true. Like I went to the Game Informer offices with the Video Game History Foundation, and I left as the co-director. So that is actually how that happened.
You did some really good scanning when you were over there. I really impressed
the team. Yeah.
So I think, lots of people will know about the Video Game History Foundation, but I'm sure some of our listeners might not. So could you just tell me, what sort of things do you do in a typical week at your job?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm glad I started writing that down recently, because it's one of those things, and I'm sure this is not unique to our nonprofit, but a nonprofit in general issue is, you wear so many hats that you kind of forget what you've done in a day. And sometimes it's not very exciting stuff like payroll and taxes and that sort of thing. But
right.
Our goal, our mission statement is, preserving and educating and celebrating video game history. But more practically, what that means is we're trying to give people the tools to be able to actually tell these stories. So,
right.
If you wanted to, for instance, write a book about a video game or write an article or make a documentary or something like that. I mean, the things that you might know how to get access to are kind of begin and end at the game itself. You know, like you probably know where to get a ROM of Super Mario World or a physical cartridge of Super Mario World. What you might not have access to is, you know, stuff from the making. And that's a bad example because Nintendo's not very... not very leaky, unfortunately, but...
Do you mean like design documents and stuff?
Or, yeah, we want people to be able to see both into how a game was made. So, you know, who were the people that worked on it and why did they make these decisions? And, you know, what are sort of the building blocks of coming to the making of that game? And then also sort of the afterlife of a game, like how it was marketed, what the company wanted people to know about it versus what they actually thought about it and how they talked about it in magazines and in reviews and, you know, further onto its impact on society. You know, how many people played it and how many people had were impacted by it. And I mean, this podcast is a very good example of ways in which video games have impacted people far beyond just, you know, this was a nice thing I enjoyed, and then I set it down and moved on with my life.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned in the intro that the New Yorker ran a piece on the Foundation's work a few months ago. Maybe it was last year, I can't quite remember. But anyway, that piece starts with quite a dynamic scene of you and your co-director, Frank, sort of rooting around in a box. I guess someone has called you up who worked in development and said, come to my house, I've got like a bunch of stuff that could be interesting. Do you do much of that, like flying to people's homes and looking in cardboard boxes from their attic?
Yeah, I mean, if we had the time and money for it, it could probably be the only thing we did full time. But
oh, cool!
Just because there's enough of them out there, you know. There's a lot of people who worked in the game industry and are only now realizing that, oh, hey, you know, this wasn't just a toy I worked on in my 20s. This actually became something that people really care about and maybe is historically important. So yeah, we do a lot of outreach to developers. We've gotten a large amount of our collection just from talking to people who worked in this industry, both currently and especially a very long time ago. It kind of relies, unfortunately, on people who, I don't want to say stole from work, because it wasn't necessarily stealing at that time. It was just kind of how people worked. But, you know, it relies on people having kept the stuff that they worked on and years and taking it home with them. Because at the time, you know, especially when we're talking about the 80s and 90s and stuff, there was no such thing as a secondary market for this stuff. There's no such thing as, you know, I've created this game and I know that we will be porting this and doing a remaster in 8 years to the next console. That was not a thing until much later. So when work wrapped up on a project, it was put in a box forever and move on to the next thing. So yeah, we do a lot of working with people's just individual collections, just what they personally worked on. And then we kind of do the other side of that, which is when people come to us and are like, hey, I'm trying to write this story or write this book, and I want to learn more about how this was created. And we try to help. And we don't always have the materials for everything. I cannot give you internal documents on Mario, for instance, but, you know, but there are a lot of things that we are able to help people out with. And that's, you know, that covers a lot of what we do, but we do some other, you touched on the fact that we do some education and advocacy. You know, we do pop-up exhibits. We are now into doing some copyright reform advocacy, because there is a whole lot of issues with globally how video games are handled. But as we're in the U.S., we really only have the the ability and understanding to focus on the U.S. for now. So
yeah, interesting. So tell me, what's the what's your personal favorite or most exciting thing that you found the most exciting discovery you found on one of these trips or excursions?
Oh, this is a very stupid answer, but it is it's an honest one. I got into this because I was kind of an aspiring historian or storyteller. Like I really wanted to learn more about how games were made and share the stories behind products, especially kind of weird ones. I'm really into the intersection of video games and strange things like, you know, the Game Boy sewing machine or the Super Nintendo entertainment bike. So I really wanted to share these stories and was just, you know, having a heck of a time coming up with this information. And so I did do a video about the history of the Super Nintendo entertainment bike, a stationary bike that plugged into your Super Nintendo. My research took forever. I'd cobbled together all of these different, you know, I was going to literal libraries, looking at literal newspapers, like trying to find just bits and pieces here, and just not coming up with much, but I managed to get enough of a story out. Well, when we were going through that Game Informer project and going through, you know, what they had, basically they had kept everything they'd ever been sent, all the press releases and everything. They had just sort of shoved into a room.
At least someone was.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I know. We would be lost without it. So while I was sorting through all of this stuff and scanning it, I found the original press kit for the Super Nintendo Entertainment Bike, and just reading through it line by line, I realized, like, oh yeah, okay, that newspaper had this line, that newspaper had this line, and I had just essentially spent all this time cobbling together what was just one piece of paper, you know, like all of the different things that were on this one piece of paper. And so
you were like reverse engineering a press release.
Exactly. I was reverse engineering a press release. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons that like people don't do a lot of video game history work, is because that's how freaking hard it is in many cases. Yeah. So this, I was so excited to find that, just to have a really good visual of like, okay, I know how long this took. This took, you know, 15 hours or whatever to cobble together this one press release. And I know how useful this one piece of paper is to telling this story. So, you know, not the most exciting answer. I mean, we found unreleased games and all kinds of like really exciting things. But for me, just as someone who wanted to tell these stories, that was a moment where I was like, yeah, someone really needs to be doing this, because no one should have to reverse engineer a press release to tell a story.
That's amazing. I mean, you mentioned a minute ago about how companies really only started valuing their back catalog, I mean, quite recently, really. There weren't remasters or re-releases, even maybe much before the year 2000, I guess. And there's all these stories of like famous games from the 90s and the 80s, like the companies just having lost the code and things like that. Like, I don't know if it's true, but, you know, Panzer Dragoon Saga is a classic game worth hundreds of dollars, and apparently Sega just lost all the code. And then there's also stories in there of Nintendo wanting to re-release one of its games and ending up using a ROM that they got from the internet or something.
So now that we have, I'm going to be careful how I word this. Now that we, now that there are internal pieces of information floating around there on the internet, we know that they have a pretty robust archive system, and
right, yeah,
it's
yeah.
not it's been migrated from so many computers and stuff that it is in no way complete, I'm sure, and I know they're likely missing stuff over there, but I'm gonna say that in particular is probably pretty unlikely.
okay Well, I think what's definitely true is that companies have not valued their history and their culture.
Well, and they've lost all kinds of this stuff. Absolutely. Like, that part is very true.
But I mean, why do you think that is? Why do you think like games aren't always treated in this way where archivists think that they should preserve them? Why is it taking like a, you know, essentially a charitable organization to do this work?
Yeah, I mean, the good news is it is starting to be taken a lot more seriously. The bad news is that it took capitalism to start making that really happen. You know, like I said, there really just was not an economic reason to keep this stuff sorted and available in any way, even internally for these companies, for a very long time, because there just was no sense that someday they would revisit it and bring it back into the world again. You know, they didn't know that there was going to be nostalgia for these games. They didn't know that they would become classics that people would, you know, want to play, or like how the technology would change over time. So there just was really no need to do that internally and to spend money on it. And I mean, you have to remember, like in the early 90s and stuff, storing data was expensive. There's a reason people even reused floppy disks, which weren't even that expensive, but would still get overwritten and used multiple times, is because storage in general was not a cheap thing. So I think that it just wasn't really valued for a very long time and wasn't really worth it for companies. I now know that a lot of companies, not all of them, but a pretty good amount of companies now have at least someone whose job that vaguely is, and then some companies do even better than that. EA has an entire archive team
Oh, nice.
That handles everything. You know, they knock on people's cubicles and go, cough it up, hand it over, and, you know, we will keep all of this internally. So it's much easier from our perspective. I mean, obviously, a lot of these companies aren't going to be like, and here you go, you guys can look at all of this publicly. But from our perspective, it is so much easier to try to cross that hurdle than to worry about, you know, it not being saved at all. So at least if companies have started thinking about this, then it exists. It hasn't been lost.
It exists.
And we can kind of go from that, go from there instead of from going from what we're dealing with right now for the early days, which is, does anyone have it? Does this exist? What do we have?
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that does bring me to something else that the foundation does sometimes is that companies have lost their stuff, and particularly things like, you know, their original key art or box art or something.
Right.
We happen to have a halfway decent amount of that, and we've actually provided it back to companies in some cases.
Can you say which game? Or are you not allowed to?
Off the top of my head, the Doom re-release, the Doom 64 re-release.
Oh, right.
One that I'm sure they will not be happy with me saying, but I have not signed anything, is that we provided source code back to Disney for the Aladdin and Lion King release.
Oh, right. Just those minor IPs.
Yeah. They don't like that, but they never made me sign anything, so.
Okay. Well, all right. We're going to do a bit of excavation ourselves now. So I've asked you to pick the five video games that you want to put on your perfect fictional console. Your first one is from 2001. So tell us about this game. What is it and why do you love it?
So the first game is Pokemon Crystal, which was not my first game or my first Pokemon game even, but I think it was kind of the game that solidified I was going to be playing video games for the rest of my life. And also the first game where I could play as a girl, that at least in my, obviously not the first game ever where you played as a girl, but it was the first one that I had ever picked up where you play, where you at least can play as a girl. So
was it the first Pokemon to do that?
It was, yeah. So I was at the exact right age to be full-fledged Pokemania, and, you know, it came out when I was a young kid, about 5 years old, I think. The Red and Blue in the United States.
Yes.
And I got a Game Boy Color for Christmas. We had already had a Game Boy in the house that was technically my dad's, but, you know, he occasionally picked up a game of baseball and that's about it. But this was, you know, my very first console, and really kind of fell in love with the world of Pokemon and just the creatures and I really liked to draw as a kid, so it gave me like just to 151 things to draw, and then when Pokemon Crystal came out, it, you know, it expanded that a lot further, and also made me really feel like, oh hey, like I can, not that the protagonist looks anything like me, but, you know, there was some level of like, I'm being represented here, and my adventure with my weird little creatures that I'm gonna draw in my notebook and instead of paying attention in math class.
Oh, nice. That's so good. So did you rename your characters as Kelsey?
Yes. Yeah.
What was the default? Because it's Ash, I guess. Well, in the Western version, at least, for the guy. What is it for the girl?
It's Chris, I believe, short for Crystal.
Okay.
Yeah. I think they're both the boy and the girl are both Chris, but it's like,
right,
C-H-R-I-S for, you know, a male Chris, and then K-R-I-S for for the female Chris.
A loophole.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Which was your favorite Pokemon to draw then?
Ooh, that is a great question. Well, I've always been very into birds. So I think I drew a lot of bird Pokemon. And there's a bird Pokemon in the Gold, Silver, Crystal series of games called Hoot Hoot, which is a very circular owl. And that's
nice.
It's like, you know, three circles, two for the eyes and one for the body, and you basically got it. So that's a good one to just kind of bang out real quick.
Do some practicing on. Excellent. So did you grow up in Seattle? Is that right? Or
no? I've been in Seattle, Washington for little over a decade now, but I actually moved around a lot growing up, which made something like a Game Boy a very, very good console for me. We did a lot of a lot of road trips and a lot of moving. I believe I lived in Detroit, Michigan when Pokemon Crystal came out, but I had moved from Baltimore to Chicago to Detroit all moving every couple of years when I was younger, and then lived in Dallas, Texas for about a decade after that before I moved here. So I've bounced around the U.S. a little bit.
Yeah, you've seen all the bits.
Yeah, but finally settled down. And yeah, I mean, as a kid, at least it was, I think there was definitely something to just kind of the first game to really capture my imagination being something that I could really escape into and had a lot of creatures and a lot of just Game Boy RPGs, as you can imagine, like they're not very detailed, but as a kid, I think that's almost better. You know, you end up filling in a lot more detail with your head.
Right, so right.
It was
If you're moving around a lot as well, like having a little world that's consistent can be quite comforting as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's definitely how I felt.
So how come you were moving around, can you say?
Yeah, my dad worked in the sports industry and he was just changing around locations for a while until he settled in.
Yeah, yeah. Did you find that hard then, trying to fit in at all these new schools and things like that?
Yeah, it was. And I think the next game we're going to talk about, I have even more feelings about how that relates, I think. But yeah, definitely had a heck of a time, especially with my move to Texas, which was very different than all of the sort of like East Coast and Midwest places I had lived before then. And realized for the first time when I moved there that other people don't move. Like that was the first time, you know, I started asking my classmates like, oh, where are you from? And they're like, what do you mean? I've always lived here and I always will. What are you talking about?
That's funny. I like asking a 10-year-old, where are you from?
Yeah. I didn't know. I thought everyone moved every few years.
Of course. Okay, well, I mean, it seems like a good time then to come to your second game. Tell us about this and why was it helpful, I guess, when you get to Texas and all that?
Yeah, so my second game and probably the most important game in my whole life is Animal Crossing. You know, I started with the first one that came out here, I should say, on the GameCube. And I didn't get it like exactly early, so I got it a little bit later. But it was around the time I had moved to Texas. And, you know, just having this literal, like very literal space that was very consistent. Because, I mean, Pokemon, it is its own world, but it's not like a town that you live in with a house and everything. Animal Crossing is literally like, I have my own house. These are my neighbors. I don't move. I stay here. And so having that, I think, was really, I don't know, very grounding for me. But also provided me like a really good social space, which sounds kind of weird to say, because obviously the animals are not real and they're not, you know, they're not literally responding to you, but there's mechanics in that game where you can write letters to your neighbors, you can post messages up on a bulletin board, and all of these things they're meant to be sort of like a communication practice, and in some ways they're meant to be for when you're playing with other people. But I didn't really have, you know, I had a younger sibling, but who played a little bit, but mostly I was playing this on my own, and so I just sort of treated it like a role-playing game a little bit, you know, like a more literal when I say role-playing, I don't mean, you know, like a video game RPG, but like a
right
literal you know, like a live action role player or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
So, you know, writing to these animals like they're my actual friends and kind of creating this this storied world for it.
The game does encourage you to do that, doesn't it? Because you can you can literally type in, can't you, a letter to, you know, like the little cow that lives around the corner or whatever, and then they will write back and maybe send you a hat or something, right?
Right, yeah. And, you know, they don't, they're not smart enough yet to, at this point, to like completely understand, you know, what you wrote and respond to it literally, but they do respond and they say something vague but engaging enough that, you know, it feels like a real conversation. And
yeah,
it was just, it was a game that I thought was really, I thought was really, really interesting at the time, but then as I got older, really appreciated it even more. And I've actually, it's not out yet, it'll be out later this year, but I've actually written an entire book about Animal Crossing.
Oh, nice.
For Boss Fight Books. So
oh, wonderful.
A very, very big game in my life that, aside from just being something that I loved when I was little, kind of grew with me through the rest of my life. And it was the first online community I was ever a part of. I became a moderator on a Animal Crossing forum site called Nook Bay.
Right.
It was eBay, but for Animal Crossing. This was more around the Wild World, which is the Nintendo DS game time.
Yeah, I remember.
But yeah, I was very, very active in that community. It was kind of what shaped my, you know, one of the things that shaped my early internet community exposure and stuff, and just really, you know, stuck with me for the rest of my life in the way that, you know, made me want to write an entire book about this game.
Yeah, amazing. So you were playing this on the, it was the GameCube version, I assume.
Yes.
Yeah. Because am I right in thinking it came out on Nintendo 64, like in Japan?
It did. And yeah, the first Animal Crossing has a really interesting development history, which, you know, it started out, was meant to be on the Nintendo 64 disk drive, a, you know, ill-fated add-on system for the Nintendo 64. And Nintendo started, you know, seeing the writing on the walls and started telling everyone who is developing games for that system that they needed to bring it back to cartridge or the project wasn't going to work out. So, you know, the original game really bears almost no resemblance to what actually shipped on the Nintendo 64. It was meant to be, you know, a lot more of a traditional game, had like dungeon crawling elements and stuff.
No way.
Yeah.
And then as
the capabilities that they were afforded by being on the 64DD were, you know, were cut, they just kind of went back to the drawing board and they're like, well, really the point of this game is communication. What should we be doing in a game that's about communication? So the original version came out in Japan only on the Nintendo 64, very late in the Nintendo 64's life cycle. I mean, the GameCube was already being shown around at various events and stuff. I mean, everyone knew it was coming. And so when that game started actually doing like fairly well in Japan, like they were, you know, they didn't really know what to expect since it's sort of a weird game. But when it started doing really well, you know, that sort of changed their plans for it. So they'd already been working on porting it to the GameCube and maybe, you know, making a few little quality of life inclusions and a few little new bonus things. Then they also started kind of rethinking bringing it outside of Japan. And so, you know, it ended up being a pretty big hit outside of Japan as well. And then they actually translated that version back into Japanese with even more additions and put that out in Japan again. So all told, the, you know, original version of, you know, when you say the original Animal Crossing, you have a Nintendo 64 version, you have two GameCube versions in Japan, you have a GameCube version in the US, which is distinct in a lot of localization ways. And then the European version is slightly distinct as well. So you have like five plus versions of this game that are all essentially the same game. It's pretty interesting.
That's amazing. You are definitely doing the right job. That's great. Everyone should look out for your book on Animal Crossing then later this year. That sounds great.
Thank you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So, yeah, I mean, tell me, were you into, obviously you're like, obviously a person who likes to hoard all this information and gather it and all of that, that's obviously a natural instinct that you have. Were you also into like collecting stuff when you were a kid?
You know, I don't think I was consciously collecting until I was much older. I would say that I didn't like to throw things out when I was a kid and I was a bit of a mess, but I don't think I started thinking about things in terms of an actual collection until I was a little older, probably around like high school or college when I started kind of seeing how other people were engaging with this idea of collecting. And I was like, oh, I don't, you know, it doesn't have to just be a pile of stuff. I can have, you know, purpose and intent behind these things and feel good about it instead of embarrassed about it.
So what was the thing that you focused on for your initial collection?
I think the very first thing I collected when it, you know, once it became a conscious decision, and this is a very silly one, but I wanted to get every color of Nintendo 64 because they came out in all those,
yes,
those beautiful, fantastic, that was Nintendo's word for it, colors, you know, just a rainbow.
Like see-through, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Very, very like millennial or millennium. You know, that see-through stuff that you saw on the IMAX and stuff, too.
Yes.
So I got every single one of those. And I actually just recently started selling some of them because I was like, you know, I don't think I actually do need 8 Nintendo 64s now that I think about it.
That's an expensive first collection as well.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, I had other things, but, like, you need a goal, right? And I was like, that's going to be my first goal. Nowadays, I'm not adding that much to my collection anymore. My really big project, which I finished probably like a year and a half, maybe two, maybe even longer than that ago, was a complete WonderSwan set, Bandai WonderSwan.
Oh, nice.
So I have every single WonderSwan game, and that took a very, very long time.
How many games are in that library?
It is, I should know this off the top of my head, it's around like 215-ish.
Okay, so doable, definitely.
It's doable, and it depends on, you know, what constitutes a complete collection for each person. So there's a couple very expensive ones, but then there's also a couple that I think it's okay to skip and still call it a complete collection, but that I managed to get. Like, there is this is going to sound so fake, and I promise this is real. There is a pregnancy tracking device for the WonderSwan.
Okay,
which is called Mama Mite, and it is a
how does that work?
So it is it's a WonderSwan and cartridge with an infrared sensor, and comes with an infrared scale. And you stand on your scale and you report, like, you know, this is my weight as I go along. And it's like, okay, you're in your third week or whatever. And these are the exercises you should be doing. This is what you should be eating. And it's just a nice little, like, logging thing for your pregnancy. As you can probably imagine, not exactly a hot seller. It took me, I think, 5 years to find a single one for sale. So,
Did it come with the scales as well?
Yeah.
Then, or was it something that the whole set?
Yeah,
right.
it's a very strange little piece of hardware. So there's a couple things like that where it's like, you know, there's probably like 50 of these in the whole world. I don't think it's reasonable to say that you need that if you want to go for the full set. But I'm that's the kind of stuff that I think is really fascinating. Is that sort of that intersection between video games and like real world applications. So that was something I was really, really interested in.
Yeah, the sort of esoteric peripheral.
Yeah.
It seems you're attracted to those.
I think they're fun. I mean, I think it's very interesting when, you know, when businesses have in the past been like, this is a way we can, you know, market this product to people or get this product into more hands. In some cases, it's just this video game is a very cheap computer, you know, like the Game Boy is a very cheap computer. And in other cases, it's maybe this will make kids into this thing, or this will, you know, maybe this will get our target audience more interested in this.
So. I remember one of the first pieces I ever wrote as a journalist was interviewing someone who tried to collect a complete Neo Geo Pocket collection.
Yeah.
And I think he had all of them. But this was like a while ago, and now that would just be so expensive, yes. I think, to try and do everything. Yes.
I'm lucky that I started this collection when I did. I mean, there were... I don't mind sharing this. Mama Mite cost me over $3,000. It was incredibly... You know, that was my purchase for the year.
Cool.
But... yeah, I mean, I started when, the very least, a lot of these games were, if you ordered them in bulk, you could get them for a few bucks a piece. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Do you mind saying how you tracked it down? Did you find it on, like, Yahoo Japan auctions or something?
Yeah, so almost the entire collection came from Yahoo Auctions, which, yeah,
right.
It's the eBay of Japan, essentially. So,
yeah.
And, you know, just a lot of saved searches and also having friends who knew that I was on the lookout for some of this stuff. I did. I bought a couple of games from another WonderSwan collector who was kind of liquidating some stuff. Yeah, I think I might have gotten almost the entire collection just from Yahoo Auctions.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I could talk to you all day about collecting video games, so we best not do that, but we should come to your third game now then, which is from 2006, an arcade game, so a little different. Tell us about this one and why it means so much
to you. So this is Dance Dance Revolution Supernova.
Dance Dance Revolution!
Which is a, you know, one of Konami's many, many rhythm games. And I am a huge enjoyer of rhythm games, but I don't want to say, you know, the rhythm game community is like this very hardcore thing that I would only really consider myself to have been a part of in this exact era of DDR Supernova. I was in middle school, I believe, when this game came out. I was probably like 13 years old. Me and two friends decided we were going to get really good at this game, and that we would be like these three girls who would show up and, you know, totally kick some ass. Like that was
so cool.
I think that was really just where it came from, was, you know, we all kind of like enjoyed rhythm games, but we were like, man, what if we just like pick a game and we just like, let's just go kick some butt. So I was not the best one of the three of us. That was my friend Shannon, who was much, much more talented than my other friend and I. But
you were her backing dancers.
Yeah, exactly. We went to the mall just about every weekend. There was a GameWorks there that is no longer there, unfortunately, in that mall. Rest in peace. But we would go every weekend and we would just spend a bunch of time on this machine, and we had PlayStation 2s at home, so we would practice at home.
We should say just very quickly for any listener who doesn't know, this is Dance Dance Revolution. So you have a foot pad, and then on the screen, little arrows come down, directional arrows, and you step in time with the music,
yes.
Either forward, backwards, left, or right.
Yes, it's a very it's a game that if you are playing on the higher levels is an enormous workout. Like it is just. We were sweaty and gross at the end of every mall session, and every time we practice and stuff, because it is just a very, you know, you're kind of sprinting once you get up to the higher levels of this. And I am embarrassed to say that although I think I can still read the notes fast enough, my legs do not move fast enough anymore. I literally, every once in a while, I want to like show off and go to the arcade and be like, oh, there's a DDR machine here. Let me, you know, pick one of the songs I used to be really good at, and I usually get about halfway through and I'm like
yeah, the machine has like a bar that you can lean on, doesn't it, if it gets too much, and you can just sort of put your weight on the bar and just let your legs fling around like you're doing a river dance or something.
Exactly, yeah, for some of the songs you almost have to, because just your legs are just moving so fast that your body is going to start throwing itself off of the arcade machine if you're not like using something to stabilize yourself. But I do remember that at 13 years old, we all decided that it was very uncool to use the bar, that made it look like you were you needed help to get through these songs. So we tried really hard not to use the bar.
Right,
But nowadays I'm like, no, that's what it's for. Why would they put it there if you weren't supposed to use it?
I guess if like the goal of your little trio is to like look and make, turn up at the arcade and all the other kids go, oh my gosh, the girls are here, like about to do their DDR. You can't be leaning on the bar. You've got to be hands-free.
Exactly. And yeah, we absolutely did. I think we accomplished what we set out to do, which was, you know, it's not like this was a crazy busy arcade or anything, but, you know, if there's enough people around, they would often gather around for a couple of minutes to watch a 13-year-old girl tear it up on the DDR machine. So,
yeah, no, definitely. Arcades are that sort of public expressions of public play. It reminds me, you know, like how all around the world these days they put pianos in public places and allow people to perform. And I've always thought that's a bit like DDR in particular, but arcade machines where, you know, it's sort of public performance of play.
Totally.
Almost. It's, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know there was technically like a Guitar Hero arcade machine and stuff, but I always thought, you know, had that been just a little bit earlier, had that been more around like the time when, and I even think, you know, Dance Dance Revolution Supernova was probably towards the, like, it's not like the end of DDR, but it's definitely not at its absolute peak, say, at that time. So maybe, you know, a little bit more closer to that other rhythm game boom, I think, would have been another really cool public show-off kind of thing, which, you know, it ended up being at, like, parties and stuff, but not so much in arcades. Yeah.
Now, tell me, you end up, I guess this is right after you graduate college, you end up co-owning a video game store. Tell me how that came about.
Yeah, so when I moved here to Seattle, I basically immediately started working at a game store called Pink Gorilla Games. There are a couple of locations in Seattle. And
is it a retro store?
It's mostly retro, but I mean, we do modern stuff and a lot of import games and stuff as well.
Uh-huh.
It had been around since 2005. I joined in 2012, so it had been around for a few years at that point. And I just got really, really into it. Like, I cared very deeply about this community. You know, I was starting to collect video games and just become a part of that community and just realizing that, like, Seattle is a really good place for it. It's a very, you know, a lot of video game companies are there. We've got Nintendo, we've got Microsoft, we've got, you know, all kinds of stuff here.
Just the little ones.
Yeah, just the little ones. And I just thought this is a really great place for this and became really into it. So I became a manager there pretty quickly while I was still attending college. And then myself and one of the other managers, we were dating at the time, basically ended up buying the business from the previous owner because he was just kind of losing interest in it. He's a lawyer. He has other right. things to do. And this was probably not making as much money as the lawyer job was making. So he, you know, agreed to sell it to us. And really, I credit my business partner with really being into the idea of like, no, we should really be the ones to take it over. We are the ones who are going to like kind of grow it and bring it to its full potential. And I think he was totally right. And it's been like 7 years now since we took it over, and we've got 3 locations now. And
amazing.
You know, I never, growing up, I was never like, I'm going to be a business owner. But in hindsight, I always had a side hustle. Like, I always was, you know, going back to second grade, I was, you know, charging people a quarter to draw something for them or, you know, something like that.
You're so running Nook Bay as well, aren't you?
Yeah. So I've always had a side hustle, and I just never thought I would, you know, be in a sort of ownership position, but I would not trade it for the world. It's hard work, but it's very meaningful to be able to really own what you do.
Yeah.
To be like, yes, this is, I made this decision and I created this. So
that's so good. I think, you know, some people might wonder, I suppose with the rise of like eBay, and we talked about Yahoo Auctions and things like that, you know, the idea of a physical vintage game store, it can seem like maybe that's going to be a hard sort of avenue to take. Why do people bring their stuff to you to like sell it to you and buy it from you rather than just doing it online?
Yeah, I mean, that part I actually feel is not so bad. I mean, eBay and these other places are, they require work. I mean, the thing that a business takes away from people is that, you know, any amount of like work or effort that goes into it, you can just drop off a box. You don't have to test it. You don't have to clean it. And, you know, we will make you a very fair offer. eBay has been, I'm almost thankful for how bad eBay has gotten, because they're now taking something like 20% just right off the top. And it's a very, very, like, you know, side with the buyers 100% of the time kind of climate out there. So already, even if you are getting top dollar for your purchases on eBay, you're actually only getting 80% of that. And then you have some risk and you have shipping costs and all, you know, all of that stuff. So it's, I think eBay used to be friendlier to sellers and tends to not be so much anymore, which is helpful for us. But beyond that, I mean, I think people also just really like the idea of having a space around that is like for them and for people like them and is convenient. I mean, we think about online shopping as convenient, and it is in a lot of ways, but so is like walking down the street and just getting something and not having to wait for it or you know, worry about package theft or anything like that. So,
yeah,
you know, I know I'm extremely biased, but I'm a very big fan of physical stores. I don't do a lot of online buying in general, even if I'm going to a big box store or a major corporation. I just really like holding it in my hands and getting it the exact moment that I want it. So
yeah, you can check it, you can see the,
yeah,
you know, open it up and all of that stuff. It's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's a major reason, especially for you know, for people to come to us rather than necessarily sell stuff to us. But you know, if you order something off of eBay and it doesn't work, your recourse is, you know, you have recourse, but it requires opening a claim and printing a shipping label and packaging something back up and shipping it. And, you know, and it, you don't have, in the meantime, you don't have your game. Whereas for us, you know, bring it in and we will either fix it or get you a new one. You know, it's a much smoother process, I think. So yeah, people definitely like to be able to kind of see condition and know that they're going somewhere that, that they can trust. And also just, I mean, I have a lot of really awesome employees who are very good at helping people when they come in and they're just like, I think I want a Game Boy, but you know, I don't know much about the system. What, you know, what do I need to know about this? What game should I play? So
yeah.
I'm very lucky to have a like passionate staff.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, anyone in the Seattle area, you know where to go this weekend. Okay. Why don't we come to your fourth game then, which is from 2010. Tell us about this
2010.
One.
This is Xenoblade Chronicles, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I am a huge RPG person, and you know, I didn't realize Pokemon was an RPG until I was much older, but started playing RPGs, quote-unquote serious ones, when I was probably around like 11 or 12 years old. And
what was your first one?
Ooh, I think, because I mean, Pokemon is the technically correct answer, but I think it was Final Fantasy IX.
Oh, nice, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, some people get cross when you call Pokemon an RPG, don't they? I've had that before.
Yeah, I mean, it literally
oh,
is,
I agree.
But
I agree.
I get it. It's not a serious one. And so I never finished Final Fantasy IX. I think the first RPG I finished was probably Final Fantasy X. But Xenoblade, for me, I think came at a time when I hadn't been playing a lot of RPGs lately. I had sort of just fallen off of the genre a little bit and just wasn't keeping up with it. and it's just, it's a game that I got absolutely just completely absorbed in. I put over, well over 100 hours into it. It's one of those games where I think it's a very intimidating game for, especially for people who don't play a lot of RPGs, because it is just one of those where you can get lost in the absolute endless side quests and side content and stuff. And it has the battle system goes a lot deeper than it sort of shares with you or teaches you. And so it's one of those things that you can get really into, or you can just kind of learn the basics and you might have to grind a little bit, but you'll get through the game. And this was always one of my favorite RPGs, like, since I played it, which was probably more like 2012 or 2013. But I really, really appreciate it now, having just finished Xenoblade Chronicles 3 and in the middle of playing the DLC for Xenoblade Chronicles 3. You know, I've now played through this entire series and just recognizing that all of the threads were, like, this was a fully realized trilogy from the very beginning.
Right, right.
That has taken almost 15 years to do, but I'm just always very impressed when I'm like, oh my god, I haven't thought about that thing in 12 years, but like, that they just connected that line that has been those dots have been set up for 12 years now, and they just finally connected.
Yeah.
So just very, very impressed by the level of storytelling in this game. And I would love to recommend it to more people, but I have to be honest. I mean, you are looking at, between all of the DLC and everything, and yes, you should play the DLC, like 300 hours of content. So
yeah, a big game. Yeah, it was when the first one came out, it really revitalized that genre, didn't it? Because it had got quite stale, I think it's fair to say. And then, yeah, Xenoblade came along and it just felt so fresh and exciting, and the world was really bright, and it takes place on these you're like a little band of adventurers, aren't you? But the world itself is constructed from these stone giants that are literally so big that, you know, you can be running along its arm and it looks like it's a giant sort of enormous field that you're running across or whatever. And so creative and interesting.
Yeah, the world building in that game is just incredible. I mean, yeah, like you said, the earth you exist upon is on two giants that are sort of locked in this eternal fight. And especially for me, I mean, the games I had been playing for the most part up until Xenoblade was, you know, a lot of Final Fantasies and stuff, but then a lot of the Tales games, which I love. I love the Tales series, but they're very, very anime. They're very, like, you have to kind of like that sort of style and know that there's going to be some of that, like, humor and entropiness to it, which I think turns some people off and maybe kind of takes them out of the story. And, you know, Xenoblade has trended back towards the anime a little bit.
But more recently,
that first one especially, I was just really, really excited by the art style and by sort of the vastness of the world and how it just felt very different than a lot of the more anime stuff I had been playing. It took itself very seriously, and it didn't fall into a bunch of anime tropes. It did in Xenoblade Chronicles 2, but we won't talk about that.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, you know, even regardless of that, just the continuity between all the games is incredible, because it's, I think my favorite part about this, and some people might hate this, but, like, it is not obvious that you're playing one giant continuous story until, I would say, like, the end of Xenoblade Chronicles 2. So you've put maybe 200 hours into a story before you even realize that, like, this whole thing is actually related.
Right, yeah.
And then, you know, towards the end of 3, you're like, ah, okay, this is how it actually all goes together.
Yeah. That's definitely going to put some people off, but the
I know I'm not going to convince a lot of people, but boy, is it good if you want a good story.
It is good, yeah. Yeah, that the director's Tetsuya Takahashi, isn't it? He, I think, he was quite junior at Square Enix as it was like in the 90s, working on with Sakaguchi, the Final Fantasy creator and stuff. So I guess that's, and those games aren't really, you know, they're Japanese, but they're not really anime type games, are they? So that's maybe why his stuff has always been. But he's always, like, had extremely large ambitions, hasn't he? Like, the games he made.
Yeah, I mean, I forget what he said the original idea behind Xenogears was, which was that PlayStation 1, you know, the first kind of Xeno game.
We ran out of money halfway through, didn't we?
But I believe he said that one, he wanted that one to be like a 5 or 6 or even 7 part story that, you know, he did one of, and then the Xenosaga games on PlayStation 2 was also cut short before the entire vision was realized. So just kind of being able to wrap up one entire vision of his is really cool. I'm very happy that he was given the chance to do that, because it's impressive.
Yeah, it's definitely a story with a happy ending, because like you say, he was working on those games and got cut short, and then he had another chance and really, really pulled it off with this trilogy. Okay, let's why don't we talk about, tell me how you first heard about the Video Game History Foundation and got involved with them, because it hasn't been going for that long, has it?
It started in 2017, technically 2016 maybe, but it wasn't really public until, publicly announced until 2017.
Yeah.
And I was, as I talked about before, I was somewhat of a aspiring historian, storyteller type. And this was right around the time I was getting really frustrated with how difficult my research was. So, I'd been bashing my head against the wall trying to find information about some of these things I was covering. And then I saw the Video Game History Foundation and kind of read about their mission, which really was, at its inception, it hasn't changed much, but I think it's definitely become more polished and focused. But at its inception was especially just look, these materials need to be out there for people because the research is really hard right now. And I was like, yes, the research is really hard right now. You get me, as a frustrated historian, I was just like, this is it. Someone gets it. And to be quite honest, I basically just started bugging Frank Cifaldi, the founder, until he started noticing me. So I had just recently graduated, college, and I had a degree in communications and business. And I was, I was kind of getting ready to buy Pink Gorilla at the time. I'm trying to think of my timing here, or maybe I already owned it. But I think my point was, I wasn't sold on the idea that I'm going to be a business owner forever. This is the only thing I'm ever going to do. But I was but I'm going to probably be able to dedicate some time to, I don't have a boss anymore. So I can dedicate some time to things that I really care about. I basically was just let me do, let me put together a communications strategy package for you. Let me do your PR or something like that. And I totally understand why Frank was just I don't know who you are, but thank you, I whipped something up and delivered it. And I was you don't have to use this. I'm just really into this and I really like what you're doing. And please let me know if I can help. And I think eventually I just kind of started showing up so much that he was oh, she's serious. She really wants to to be a part of this, and she's putting in some work. So, the first thing that we did, that I did kind of together with the foundation, was that very first pop-up exhibit at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, as you mentioned in the beginning. And yeah, I think from there it was just, it became a I became the first full-time, not full-time, but the first very dedicated, I'm always here volunteer for the foundation, and really just out of a I need this to work because I need this in the world. So please just, I'll put whatever effort I need to into this so that my research is easier in the future and the research is easier for other people in the future.
Yeah.
And of course, the irony of that is that I have very little time to actually do research now.
Yeah.
But someday.
Someday, yeah. One thing I wanted to ask, so I know that the foundation does sometimes acquire, you mentioned, prototypes or unreleased games and things like that. And sometimes those come via donations, but sometimes they're literally you'll see it on eBay and you'll be competing against collectors or whatever to try and get it. And, since the pandemic, the vintage and retro game market seems to have increased in a lot of value, and people are spending a lot more money to get stuff. So how do you go about getting hold of a rare Nintendo prototype or something when you're bidding against people with very deep pockets?
We try to be strategic about that because we are, we're a nonprofit. We don't have a ton of money, and most of our money does come from just individual donors. We don't have a big government backing or a big, we don't have a wealthy benefactor funding the entire operation. So we try to be strategic about it. We have fundraised specifically for things like that before, where, we'll just kind of get pledges from people and be like, if this is extremely important to you that we get this, then, just let me know how much you will be willing to spend, if and when we get it. So, we'll take the money afterwards kind of thing. But actually, we've had a pretty good amount of success in just kind of negotiating with some of these deep pocketed people. We had a situation recently where someone purchased, someone kind of outbid us. But then we were like, hey, if we pay you, X amount of dollars, like, would you allow us to digitize this and preserve it and release it and stuff? And we've had some success with that. I mean, that kind of, it comes down to individual buyers and stuff. But, we're mostly concerned with just making sure that this stuff is safe and accessible. But we also do want to be smart about it, because if it starts getting to a point where, someone wants $15,000 for something that is very, very, like, 2 weeks from final, like, no major differences kind of thing, like, that's just not worth it to us. There's so much more we can do with that $15,000. There's so much more we can save and provide to people. So I think, it really depends on how much we value the object itself, and we try to balance it. How much is this actually going to help people?
There was a big story in the news, and it was like on all the news channels, like over here in the UK, about the sale of that copy of Super Mario 64, a sealed copy that went for like $1.5 million. I don't know, 18 months ago, whatever. I mean, I know that particular game has got a whole other controversy around it, but do you think in general that prices are going to continue rising, or is it overvalued at the moment?
I think they've already started to fall, especially in that sealed collectibles market. It's something I like to kind of try to tell or share with people so that, you don't get too freaked out by this stuff, is there really are two parallel markets happening right now. There is the sort of like video game collecting, the standard classic video game collecting that's been happening, since the late 90s, really, which is, people collecting by and large not sealed versions of games, just, either loose or maybe in their box or something. Maybe you want a really nice copy, but in general, not sealed stuff. And people who tend to value the rarity of the actual, did this game sell 2,000 units or did it sell a million units? So
yeah.
Then you have the other track, which is really people that come out of the other collectibles worlds. It's people who were in sports cards and movie memorabilia and comic books and that sort of thing. And they approach game collecting very, very differently. They tend to do things like the way comic books work, like first appearance of,
right,
and, being really valuable, even if that thing has 3 million of them, or first print of Mario, even though really it's the Japanese one that's the first print of Mario. But, there's a little bit of, I don't want to say xenophobia, but like there's definitely a little bit of like,
right,
Americanization and,
okay, yeah,
and that sort of thing of that market. So that market, obviously, both markets took off in a big way in the pandemic, but that market especially, I feel like, really skyrocketed. I mean, yeah, Super Mario 64, even in incredible condition, selling for that much money is, it's not going to happen again for a really long time. I mean, we've already seen a pretty major drop in that market. There was a real gold rush for a while that is just not there anymore. Heritage Auctions, which is one of the big collectibles sites, is still running video game auctions, every month or so, and the stuff's just not, it's just not going for the meteoric prices that it was before. And I would say the regular collectible, game collecting market is cooling off a little bit too, maybe partially in economy based. I think all of this stuff does better and gets bigger in a booming economy, but it ebbs and flows. I think it will, go up again someday, but I think we're not in a period of like hyper growth right now. No. Thankfully.
Yeah, sounds good. maybe a time to get you another copy of the Wonder Swan pregnancy game then.
If I can find one. No one cares about that. That's not something,
right,
that would ever sell at a if I put that up at an auction site, I'm sure it would go for like $200 because,
sure,
people would be like, what is that?
Right. Okay, Kelsey, we better come to your fifth and your final game, which is from 2014. Tell us about this one.
So this is Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate. Which is kind of a random one in the middle of the Monster Hunter series, but it's the first one that, not the first one I played, but the first one that like really became a big part of my life. You said it was 2014?
Apparently. I looked it up before.
Okay, all right. my perception of everything from like 2014 to 2018 is very bad. So this was a game that we started holding a lot of events at Pink Gorilla for like meetups for this game because... Really, just because myself and you know my business partner were like really into it at the time. We were still managers at this point. I don't think we hadn't quite come to owning the place yet, but you know we had a lot of capability to do stuff like that, to run these events, and it just became a really big part of my social life in a way that I think was kind of rare in 2014. Man. You know, like in this modern era, there's not a lot of. You know, people aren't doing LAN parties anymore. People aren't really doing these sort of everyone come together and play games in the same space so much anymore. So it was just a really exciting thing to capture that again. So every week we had a meetup at the store after hours and we'd have, you know, pizza and print out spreadsheets for the game because all of the quality of life stuff that they've added since was not in it yet. So,
right.
You know, you had to remember like, okay, if you're doing this fight, this is if you're trying to build this sword, this is what you need to fight, and don't forget to bring this item and this item, or you will die. So
we should briefly explain. So in this game, you people are literally joining up together to go and hunt dinosaurs, essentially, aren't they? And then they
yes.
take the dinosaurs apart.
It is Monster Hunter, the most aptly named. Game in the whole world, probably.
Yeah, says what it does on the tip. But then the bit you're referring to is that you use like the horn of the rhino to make a shield or
right.
whatever.
Yeah, so it's a game.
You have to find the ingredients.
Yes,
you?
So it's a game that just kind of that keeps building on itself. I mean, you can play it single player, but it's often played multiplayer, and there's online capabilities and stuff. But there was also local, and for a game on the 3DS, you know, that was really nice to just kind of all gather in one place. You don't need anything other than maybe an outlet if, you know, batteries start getting low. And team up in groups of four to just go hunt a big monster. And then by hunting that monster, you'd get parts to, you know, make yourself even stronger. So you could go hunt an even bigger monster so that you could get more parts to get even stronger. And
the circle of life.
Yeah, exactly. So it was just a fun, like... You know, you could have someone who is relatively new to the group come in and you could be like, OK, we'll just join up and stand back. We'll just bash a few, you know, easy monsters for you so that you can get some pieces, build some armor, and then you can join us on the harder hunts. It's very easy to kind of, you know, kind of MMO like in that way, you know, just get people up to speed really fast. And
but how lovely to do that in a physical space like in your store. That's
yes.
great, isn't it?
Yeah, it was so nice. It was just a really... nice way to get to socialize, and you know that was how I spent my early 20s. I was playing video games, but I love that. I love that there still were games, and I'm sure there are still games like this. They're fewer and further between now. Even in 2014, that felt like a kind of antiquated thing to essentially have a LAN party inside of a game store. But I'm very thankful for it because I think that was just a really fun. Time for me socially.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you talking about it makes me feel nostalgic, even though I wasn't there. It sounds
yeah.
It sounds great. Okay, Kelsey, let me go through your console then. So we got Pokemon Crystal, Animal Crossing, Dance Dance Revolution Supernova, Xenoblade Chronicles, and Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate. That's a pretty cool console. How are you feeling about it?
I love it. I love it. It would keep me entertained for a pretty long time.
Yeah. Okay, we need a name for your console. Have you got any thoughts of what we could call this?
I think because I didn't pick any WonderSwan games for this, but, you know, I do love the WonderSwan. I think we should call it the Wonder Goose. Because I am a bit of a silly goose.
That's correct. The Wonder Goose. Oh, that's so good. I love that. The WonderSwan is such a strange little console, isn't it? But great. Was it designed by Gunpei Yokoi? Am I making that up?
It was. And he was, so he had left Nintendo at the time. This was, you know, shortly after the whole Virtual Boy debacle, which is its own whole story. He left Nintendo to start a little design company called Koto Laboratories. And they were working with, they were making some like little electronic gadgets and stuff, but they started working with Bandai on a console. And it's very, you know, design wise, it is very Gunpei Yokoi. It's very much that he has this whole like philosophy of lateral thinking with withered technology.
Yes,
so it's a very... Yeah.
That's what he said about the Game Boy, wasn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yes. It's very
they
Game
had
Boy.
Loads of really, really cheap LCD screens. And
yes.
It was like, what can we do to sell these?
Right. Exactly. So it's a very, you know, it's a cheap console, but that's done very effectively. And the thing I think is so interesting, there's a couple things I think are so interesting about it. He unfortunately got hit by a car and passed away before the console came out. But the two things I really love about it are that it's designed so that games can be played either horizontally or vertically. And developers could take advantage of that and be like, I want a section in my game that is vertical, or, you know, you could have a shoot 'em up on it that had the, you know, the screen oriented that way. But the other thing that was really cool, and this came a little bit later in its life, but that it was a very big hotbed in Japan of like the early homebrew scene.
Right.
So they actually sold a consumer development kit through this company called Cute that that anyone could buy, and you could just develop your own WonderSwan game and put it on a little cartridge. And they held competitions for, you know, submitting your game, and they only did it 2 years because unfortunately the console just didn't last very long. But the winners of those competitions those 2 years got their game published on a full cartridge and released. And I just think that's such a cool, you know, this is kind of very early indie scene, kind of pre-indie scene over here at least.
Yeah.
And just a really cool way of like letting people into that on a console before that became an easy thing to do.
Yeah. Ah, so cool. Well, okay, with the Wonder Goose then, we'll have to have horizontal and vertical alignment and allow for homebrew games.
Exactly.
Great. Kelsey, it's been so good to talk to you. And thank you for sharing your time and your memories. And also, thank you for the work that you're doing, which I know is just going to be seen as very valuable in the future when people are trying to figure out the early decades of the video game industry. So yeah, thank you for all your work.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much to my guest, Kelsey Lewin, the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation. And together with her co-director, Frank, and the other volunteers and people who work with the Video Game History Foundation, they are just doing such important work to preserve documents, press releases, pieces of hardware, early versions of games, unreleased games, all of these things that are being collected, stored, categorized, scanned, and held in museum exhibits and in a library as well. This is important work for anyone who is interested in the early years of video game culture and design and development, as of course people will be for decades and years to come. You know, preserving this stuff is crucial. If these people don't do it, it will be lost forever. And in 100 years, when historians, researchers, academics and authors want to find out information, they'll have to rely on incomplete archives on the internet or whatever it is. So this is important work. You can read more about the Video Game History Foundation's work by visiting gamehistory.org, and it's goes through their mission, their current projects, and you can read up on the team and also follow their blog. They also have a podcast too. You can follow Kelsey and her co-director, Frank Cifaldi, on Twitter, and they are often doing advocacy and threads on why copyright laws need to be changed, and also sort of doing fundraisers for particular prototypes or cartridges or discs that they want to acquire for the foundation and put out into the world and to preserve and archive. So it's worth following all of these avenues. Really important work. At the start of that conversation, I referenced a New Yorker piece. If you search for the piece, it's titled The Collectors Who Save Video Game History from Oblivion, and it's by Bijan Stephen. A wonderful piece, well worth your time, so go and read that as well. Anyway, aside from all of that, it was just wonderful to hear Kelsey's choices, her story, how she's wound up in this rather unusual role and her path that led her there, and of course her other hat as well of being a co-owner of a vintage video game store in Seattle, Washington. She has obviously, as you can hear from that conversation, deep and impressive knowledge, and so it was great to hear some of that, to hear some of those anecdotes. And of course, we'll all be looking out for her book on Animal Crossing, coming out later this year through Boss Fight Books. You can write to me at myperfectconsole@gmail.com with any thoughts, with any feedback and suggestions for guests. Thank you to those of you who do. I get suggestions for guests all the time through email, through messages on social media and all of that. And yeah, it's really helpful, and all goes into a list that I'm compiling and approaching various people. At the moment, just sort of bringing out episodes at least one a week, and occasionally I might do two a week depending. I've got quite a few backed up, but they'll definitely be seeing us through to the end of the year. So yeah, but please do keep those suggestions coming. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at My Perfect Console with the O's removed, or on Instagram, My Perfect Console with the O's in place. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Simon Parkin. Okay, I will be back again next week with a new guest with their five games and with one more perfect console. Until then, have a wonderful week. Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.